This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org. I'll begin. Welcome, everybody. I'm Diana Winston, and welcome to our Monday sitting. So I was going to talk today about, essentially about the science of meditation and mindfulness. And I want to talk about it because it's very inspiring and interesting, and this is kind of a talk about what's going on out in the world in relation to meditation and mindfulness. And as you listen to it, you know, think, one of the reasons it's interesting is that it can be very inspiring when you start to know, like, what actually happens when we meditate. How does it change our bodies? How does it change our brains? It can be quite inspiring. And sometimes for myself, I'll practice, or I'll sort of not want to practice, and I'll feel like, oh, I don't feel like meditating today. And then I'll remember, oh, but this is actually impacting my brain. It's affecting my genes. This is a great thing to do. But most of the time, for many of us, we just practice because we like it, and it's good. You know, it's a good thing to do. So you don't have to be sold by the science, and the purpose is not to sell you on this. It's just to tell you about it and give you some information that I think is really interesting. I work at the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA, and we're a center, an education and research center, and we're connected with something called the Cousin Center, which is this big mind-body research center where they're doing tons of research studies on mindfulness, but also on yoga and tai chi and different mind-body practices to look at that interconnection between the connection between mind and body and the impact that they have on each other. And then our center does mostly the education, and we do a lot of a lot of classes and programs on mindfulness. But we're often teaching mindfulness for research studies to sort of further the science. Now, something to keep in mind as I talk about this: first of all, I'm not a scientist, so you may have questions, and later on you can ask me questions, and I may have absolutely no idea what the answer to your question is. So, But I'm someone who's been exposed to it now for a number of years, working at UCLA in the medical school, in this research department. It's in the Semmel Institute, which is what used to be called the neuropsychiatric department. So we're in the psychiatry department. And by the way, it's really, really cool that the medical school at UCLA has a department devoted to mindfulness. Isn't that amazing? And mind-body practices. And, you know, it just shows how far this has come. Like, I started practicing, whatever, 20-something years ago, and it was totally hidden. You never told anybody that you meditated because you were weird. Mm-hmm. And then now, it's in all these magazines, and people are talking about it all the time, and people, it's part of certain health systems. Like, for instance, Kaiser has people practice mindfulness. You know, it's in these mainstream institutions. So it's this incredible arc that I've seen. And I think in no small part, it's about the way that science has said, hey, you know, look how good this is. Look how helpful this is with physical issues, with mental health issues, with training attention, with working with impulse control, with actually changing our bodies and brains. I think in some ways you might think of the Buddha as the original neuroscientist, mm-hmm. right? The Buddha went in and he looked at it, he explored what was happening in his body, in his brain, his mind. He didn't call it that. And he came to a lot of conclusions that now, 2,600 years later, people are saying, oh, this actually is true. This is right. And so we're all scientists of our own body and mind. And we're all doing these practices, and we're finding out, oh yeah, this works. This is actually having an impact on my life. And so so it makes sense in some ways that contemporary science is kind of showing what people found out to be true thousands and thousands of years ago. And the thing that I think is funny is sometimes you'll read these studies and you'll go, wait a minute, duh, of course that's true. So for instance, there was a study that they did last year where they were exploring what meditation is best for what person. So there were tons and tons of different kinds of meditation practices, and they looked at Vipassana, they looked at Zen, they looked at yoga, they looked at Tai Chi, something else. And they tried to come up with an answer of who should do what. And so here's what the scientists found. The answer is whatever you're going to do. Know what I'm saying? Kind of obvious, kind of really, really obvious, of course, whatever you're going to do. So if you practice Zen and you don't like it, but you're very attracted to yoga, you're going to keep doing it, right? So, okay, so this is like, you know, I don't know, $50,000 and a big grant to tell us something that we already know, you know. So it's a little bit funny also. And a last caveat I'll say before I get into it is that the science is really young. So sometimes with meditation practice, everybody's really excited. Oh, science just said you can change your brain if you meditate. You can change your genes. Oh my gosh, how amazing. Well, they're small studies. So the gold standard in research is that there's been it's been replicated, that there's control groups, that there's large samples. So studies with thousands of people are considered the gold standard. Much of what's done in the research around mindfulness and meditation is very small. And there's only probably maybe 1,000 studies out, so which sounds like a lot, except that if you were to look up how many studies are there connected to heart disease and exercise, you would probably find, anybody guess? Like 50,000 studies, right? So I think it's like 46,000, something like that. So what that shows is that the mindfulness research is very young. So now people are waving these flags and saying, look, science tells us mindfulness is so great, meditation is so good for you, but it's still very early in the field. So let me talk about some of the areas that that we've seen some interesting research. And I hope this is interesting to you. Are you interested in the science? Yeah? Okay, just want to make sure. So let's start with the relationship to pain. And the reason I'll start here is because the very early days of taking meditation out of the Buddhist context and bringing it into a more secular context and starting to research it, have the scientists research it, started with Jon Kabat-Zinn. Many of you are familiar with Jon Kabat-Zinn because he's now kind of the face of mindfulness. He was a molecular biologist, I believe, at the University of Massachusetts. And he had been a Zen meditator for like many, many years. And one day, some doctors came to him and said, we have all these pain patients, these chronic pain patients who are really suffering, and we can't do anything. We can't, the medication isn't working, the therapies aren't working. Is there anything you can do? And he said, I'm going to try to teach them meditation and see what happens. And so he taught them, he went through this whole course of meditation with them, which later became what many of you are familiar with, mindfulness-based stress reduction, an 8-week course teaching the fundamentals of mindfulness, what you do, essentially what you do here, with all the religious stuff removed from it. And what they found is at the end of the 8 weeks, there was a marked improvement in people's pain, that they actually started to feel better. And the other thing they found was if they didn't feel better, their ability to tolerate the pain had shifted dramatically. And so that their quality of life had changed, that they were able to have a more open and spacious and relaxed awareness in relation to these chronic illnesses that they had been dealing with and the chronic pain. So these studies have been replicated quite a bit, and it's kind of the seminal studies, but it's pretty amazing because we know from meditating, or some of you are new, I realize, but we know from meditating that there's a difference between pain and suffering, right? That pain is what happens. You know, pain is we experience pain. We get sick. We, you know, bang ourselves up. We have emotional pain, but pain happens. Suffering is the layering that we put on top of it. The self-blame, the self-pity, the fear, the judgment, the catastrophizing, oh, this terrible thing that happens to me, it's going to ruin my life, I'm going to be in the hospital from it, you know, whatever happens in that our mind is creating, that's the suffering. The pain is just the physical pain. So with mindfulness, or emotional pain, with mindfulness, what was being taught by Jon Kabat-Zinn was how to be present with the pain itself without going into the stories that created the suffering. So that was like the the start of this. So now there's been studies, like all sorts of studies, looking at the impact of mindfulness on stress-related conditions, on blood pressure, on the immune response, and the healing response. And there's been so many interesting things that are coming forward. And it basically, mindfulness is really helpful if you have any stress-related condition. It just helps. However, research shows that other meditation helps too. And even other things help too. So for instance, if you have high blood pressure and you put a blood pressure cuff on you and you check it periodically, that helps reduce your blood pressure. It has the same benefit of if you meditate. And so it'll reduce your blood pressure. Which one is better? Should you do a blood pressure cuff? Well, the thing is, meditation also gives you other added benefits. So that's one of the reasons that you might want to do it. There's been studies, for instance, there is an interesting study done with people who have psoriasis, which is that itchy skin condition. And so the typical treatment for that is you go into almost like these tanning booths. They're UVB rays go on your skin, and that heals the psoriasis. Well, what they did was they had people do that in just the typical treatment, and another group listened to a meditation CD and practiced mindfulness, very much just like what we did tonight, along with the CD. And at the end of the day, they compared it at the end of the treatment, and they found that the people who meditated while getting the treatment healed 3 times faster than the people who just got a regular treatment. This is really interesting. This boosting the immune system. Our healing response is somehow responding to the meditation practice. And this has been done in all sorts of ways, looked at in different ways. There was a study at UCLA looking at people who are HIV positive and having them practice over 8 weeks and seeing what happened. And over those 8 weeks, the people weren't even practicing that much, but if they were in the meditation course, their T cell count, which is a marker of their immune system, stayed stable. And the people who didn't meditate, their T cell count went down. So it's interesting. If we meditate, it affects our physical health. Science is showing us that this is affecting our physical health. It's also impacting attention. So you probably saw that when you were meditating tonight, what did we do? Our mind would wander off, and then you would collect it and come back to the present moment. Our mind would wander off again, and we'd come back to the present moment, and that's what we did the whole night when we were just doing this 30-minute meditation. Of course, that trains us in attention. So if you think about it, for our whole lives, most of the time people are saying, pay attention, but they don't tell us how to pay attention, right? And kids in school, pay attention, class, but you're not taught how to pay attention. And so the tool of mindfulness is a one way of learning attention training. And this is very, very helpful. And so when research has been done and we've looked at it, we actually did a study a few years ago where we looked at people who were ADHD, teenagers and adults, to see how meditation would impact their experience. And what they saw at the end of 8 weeks was that their attention ability improved. Now, there's different kinds of attention. And the specific attention that improved was something called conflict attention. Conflict attention is if there's many things competing for your attention, can you stay focused on one thing? This improved. This improved with the teenagers. I mean, everybody said, really? Teenagers can meditate? Are you serious? And they could. They absolutely could. And some of the researchers looked at the results and they said, wow, this is amazing. What kind of medication did you put them on? We said, no, it was meditation. Right? And so the ability to attend more thoroughly and directly is something that you see as you practice. So if you have attentional issues, you will improve them as you meditate. And it's interesting because sometimes people who have ADHD will say, oh God, it's so hard for me to meditate. My mind is all over the place. Well, actually, it's a good thing, right? Because here's what happens. You have many, many, many more opportunities to bring your mind back to the present moment. And if you think about it, it's almost like our mind is like a muscle. This muscle of mindfulness that we're training. We're training this muscle. We just keep repeating it over and over, and our brains actually begin to shift. And I'll talk about that more. But that's what happens. You train it, and it gets better. And I'll go into the brain science in a minute. So attention is a big thing that gets impacted. And then another area that's important that they've looked at, and I don't know so much about the studies in this, but basically any kind of program that's connected to impulse control, like a smoking cessation program or a food addiction program or other addictions seems to be helped with mindfulness. So if you add mindful eating to an already existing program on working with food issues and weight, it improves the efficacy, which is nice to know that mindfulness as itself is a tool that can be complementary to other things. So we can go into the area of mental health. There's when you look at the studies, across the board, and there's, what I said, like 1,000 studies, and you look at them, what's in common? There's one thing that people find in common in these studies, and this is that mindfulness makes us happier. It's so interesting. They'll look at all the variables. Did it help their blood pressure? Did it help their cortisol level? What did it do? What did mindfulness and meditation do? People report happiness and more joy in their life. And so it's really amazing to think that as you practice, you're getting happier. I'm just curious, how many people think they've gotten happier since they started meditating? See, we just did a scientific study. No, I'm kidding. We did not. This is very unscientific. But you see how you feel. Like you know this. This is what I meant when I said in the beginning, that all of this stuff I'm telling you, you kind of know. And you know because you practice. But mindfulness, that now the research are showing, it's being proven. So there was a study done, I guess it was out of Harvard, it came out a year ago, looking at people to see if they were in the present moment or not. And the way they did it was they buzzed people on their smartphones over the course of a day, random intervals, they got buzzed. And it was, I think, 2,500 people, something like that. And they just said, they asked them three questions when they got buzzed. What are you doing? Is your mind on it? And how are you feeling? And what they found was that if people were doing something, keeping their mind on it, they reported being happier than if their mind was all over the place. So a wandering mind does not lead to happiness, is what this showed. Even if your mind was wandering to something fun and interesting, it still wasn't as good as keeping your attention on it, on the present moment. Even if you were doing something you hated, your mind was, if you kept your mind on it, they reported more happiness. So it's just an interesting study about what, and we have that experience when you're really right in the moment and you're not lost in the past, lost in the future, but you're just right here, right now. There's an incredible sense of well-being that comes. So again, we can feel this for ourselves. We can know this to be true. Mindfulness has been incorporated into a lot of treatment programs, so for depression, for anxiety, for obsessive compulsive disorder, so there's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. All of these incorporate mindfulness as part of the treatment. But you don't have to have a particular, you know, clinical diagnosis to benefit from mindfulness. It helps with mental health. So when you think about, one thing I like to think about, there's this really interesting study I'll tell you about, that about how emotions work. One of the things that happens with emotions is we get completely lost in our emotions. So we're in an emotion, it's really intense, and we get kind of overwhelmed. What mindfulness can do is help us to kind of recognize, all right, I'm in the midst of fear, I'm in the midst of sadness, I'm in the midst of whatever it is. And so and then when you do that, sometimes that calms us down and helps us relax a little bit. Are you guys familiar with the RAIN acronym? RAIN, recognize, accept, investigate, not identify. I'm not going to go into it, but it's just a way of working with emotions. So there was a study that people did where they looked, this is also UCLA, where they looked at emotions and what happens in the brain. So they hooked people up to find out what the activity that was happening in the brain, like an EEG. And they saw that, or maybe it's a brain scan, I forget. So what they did was they put faces on a screen that were either scared faces, disgusted faces, angry faces. Now, and then what that does is when you see this flash, your brain kind of gets activated. What gets activated is what's called the amygdala. So some of you probably, you know, neuroscience is getting more well accepted, more known. The amygdala is like the primitive part of your brain. You have no control over your amygdala. Your amygdala is going to react. When you're fearful, when you're angry, when you're disgusted, your amygdala is going to just light up, just get activated. what they had people do was label what they saw on the screen. So if they saw angry, they would say angry. If they saw fearful, they'd say fearful. And then they start to see what was happening to their brain. Well, when they labeled the emotion correctly, which is they brought mindfulness to the emotion, the amygdala calmed down and the prefrontal cortex went online. So the prefrontal cortex is kind of like the CEO of your brain. The CEO of your brain, which means like it's responsible for delayed gratification, for flexible thinking, for synthesizing information from body and brain, for working memory. So it's the part of your brain that you want really to go online. So I don't know if some of you have ever seen Dan Siegel. Do you know Dan Siegel? So Dan Siegel, he does it. He says, this is your brain. You can imagine this is your brain. This is your frontal lobe. That's the amygdala, right? So when you're freaked out about something, it's like your prefrontal cortex is gone. It's not in activation. You have no kind of conscious control of what's going on, but your job is to bring it online so that you can begin to calm the body and mind, be self-aware, and act from a different in a different way. And so this is what they saw, but the scientists saw by labeling an emotion, it actually transformed the brain. That's pretty interesting. So maybe I'll just do a little bit more with the brain research, and then we'll see where we are after this. The brain research has been probably the most interesting field of mindfulness study right now, and that's partially because neuroscience is getting really big these days, and it's still really small. Like, we still don't really know anything about the brain. The neuroscientists will tell you they don't really know anything about the brain. So oftentimes you'll hear people saying, well, the brain does this, the brain does that, but it's more complex than that. The seminal study that was done in 2005 looked at the brains of long-term meditators. So these were the people who've had 20 to 30 years of meditation, like people living in caves and practicing in the Himalayas. They looked at these monks who had been practicing for you know, decades, for at least 40,000 hours of meditation. And what they did was they looked at their brain. You might think of them as kind of the Olympic athletes of meditation, right? These are the heavy-duty guys. So they looked at their brains and they compared their brains to people of the same age range. And what they saw was that, I don't know if you know this, but as you age, your brain thins out. Did you know that? No? Yes? No? Okay, if you want something else to worry about, you can worry about what's called age-related cortical decline. Well, these guys who meditated, it didn't happen. There was some protective mechanism in their brain. Their gray matter was staying thicker, more robust, especially in these same areas that we're talking about, the prefrontal cortex, which I mentioned earlier, and also the insula cortex, which is the one that synthesizes information, body and brain. So now the question they probably want to ask is, well, were these guys, did they just have really thick brains before? And because we don't know, they're not doing longitudinal studies, we don't know. So we don't know the answer to that. But now they've done two studies. Someone did a study where they correlated the thickness of your cortical layers, the many cortical layers, which is something you want. They compared it to people who meditated for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and they saw that the more that you meditated, the more cortical layers you have. Again, something desirable, something that thickness, thickening. But they've done stuff with novice meditators. So last year, the year before, they looked at people who'd only been meditating for 8 weeks, and they saw that they had minute brain thickening happening in the same areas of the brain, this prefrontal cortex, and also one other area, forgetting it right now, but responsible for self-awareness and compassion. Those areas seem to thicken, even in just 8 weeks, which is kind of remarkable that we can change our brain in 8 weeks. So this is connected to the idea of neuroplasticity. Are you familiar with neuroplasticity? Neuroplasticity is the idea that we can change our brains. For a long time, they used to think that brains stopped developing at, like, first they thought it was 18, and then they thought 20, 22, 25. Anyway, the brains, they now realize that our brains can continue developing throughout our lifetime. And they develop based on what you do with your brain. So this is really, really important. In other words, if you want to become really, really mean, just practice it. That will change your brain. You will just practice being mean. If you want to be really kind, practice kindness. And this is very much sort of what the Buddha said, right? You know, he said, what you plant, what seeds you plant, you will cultivate. If you put in a fig tree, you're going to get a fig tree. You're not going to get a peach tree. What you practice, you will cultivate. And so neuroplasticity is often shown by, for instance, they did a study in England where they looked at taxi drivers. And if any of you have been to, it's in London, if any of you have been to London, you know it's incredibly complex, right, to drive around London. So they looked at the brains of these taxi drivers and they saw that the part of the brain responsible for reading maps and navigation was thicker than people the same age, because that's what they practiced. So the idea is what you practice is going to change your being. It's going to change your brain. It's going to change how you live in the world. That's what neuroplasticity tells us. And it's very exciting. It's really interesting to think about that. Maybe last areas I'll mention is that there's a lot of research being done on compassion and how our heart gets impacted, essentially. And there's a study, there's a center at Stanford University right now called CCARE, the Center for Compassion something. And I can't remember what it stands for, but CCARE, they do compassion research. And there's a woman who, I love her work, she's at University of Texas, named Kristen Neff, who's developed this construct of self-compassion, which I talked about many months back. But it's the combination of when you bring mindfulness and loving kindness and an awareness of our shared humanity together. And as people practice these things, the science is showing that people change. And you can create, what some of the research does is it creates situations where you're sure to feel bad. So for instance, there's something called a social exclusion paradigm, where you're brought into a research center and you're told that the other people are judging you. Basically, there are other people in the study and their job is to judge you. And then, you know, and so it's like can you imagine? It's really, really unpleasant. But what they did was they taught people a little bit of compassion practice, just a little bit of compassion practice. And those people were able to not respond in such an intense way, that they actually were a little bit more equanimous, more at ease, and kinder to themselves when subjected to a difficult social situation. So and then they teach people loving kindness, and they explore what's happening in the brain. And one of the things that's interesting is people begin to see loving kindness reflected in other people. The science has shown that they practice it and they see it in other people. But then they also say, like, I could sense loving kindness coming from the lamppost or something. Like, it begins to grow and grow and grow. And so something is changing in our bodies, brains, minds, all of that. Anyway. So that's kind of an overview of the field as I see it, and it's changing every day, and there's new studies. There's something called Mindfulness Research Monthly that tells you the latest studies that come up every month. And I'm hoping that, again, that I'm giving you this in the spirit. I know it's kind of like an intellectual talk, but it's more in the spirit of, may this inspire you for your practice. May you know that you can change your body, you can change your brain, you can reduce stress. There are even, I forgot to mention this, but there are even studies showing that it helps with changing gene expression, right? Like that it protects our genes, it protects the telomerase, I'm not going to get into it, but the little thing at the end of our DNA is protective. There's a protective function, and when you meditate, it strengthens that. So imagine, we can change our genes, we can change our body. So practice. So that's anyway, the point of this whole talk tonight, practice. Practice, it's really good for you. It's really good for you in all of these ways. Okay. So I guess there's plenty of time. Let's just see if there's questions or thoughts, and I hope I can answer. If I can't, I'll forward you somewhere else. Okay, so yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That was very inspiring. And I feel like I almost am a little too inspired by mindfulness. And, like, I already, you sold me before you even started the talk. I find that through the years, the changes haven't, for me, they've been very subtle and hard for me to notice. And especially, like, today I was having a really rough time. And I, as I was hearing it, I was like, well, none of that stuff's happened to me, and it's not where, you know, and it's so what I can't move to the Himalayan cave, you know, and so I just want to, like, do you ever hear anything about that? Like, maybe expectations being a little too high for, like, especially because I'm really kind of greedy and distracted, like, you know, and a consumer, I'm just used to being, like, really entertained. I'll stop talking.
Well, that's it. That wasn't... So I think the question I'm hearing is, does it, for some, well, wait, let me check. Are you saying for some people does it not work, or what do you do?
Well,
or?
I'm just saying that sometimes, like, I can use these talks that, like, maybe I'm doing it wrong or something, you know, that I can kind of use it against myself.
I see. Okay, so that we don't want to do. This was not to make you feel bad.
No, it was right.
Just to be clear.
Sorry,
So I think it's mostly, here's another thing. Okay, I didn't really say this, but you're practicing because of some desire and some love of what you're doing, right? And this is often why people practice, because there's just, they know, they don't care about the science. They may not even know about the science, but they know intuitively that it's good for them. And our progress in meditation is not like this. You know, people think I start at point A and I get to point Z, and that's what meditation is about. And then one day I'll be at point Z, and then I'll be killer. You know, that's it. And it's not like that. It's much more like this, is my experience. So that's one way of talking about it. Another way of talking about it is it's more like a spiral. You know, so sometimes we're going up, and sometimes we're going down, and we're going around. And that we have to trust that that's part of the practice. That if we set these expectations, we're going to have these, like, incredible experiences, and we're going to get rid of all of our anger and all of our frustration. We're in for some trouble. So it's really about, maybe you were saying, lowering the expectations, connecting with the love and the inspiration, and trusting that in the long term shifts are happening, which I'm convinced they are. Yeah. In the back.
Thank you so much for the talk. It was very informative, and I love the intellectual talk. And you mentioned the study about how wandering minds are less happy than the focused ones.
Yes. I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know the answer from a scientific perspective about how that impacts the brain. I mean, it also, I think it, of course, it really depends on the type of video game. So a game that's all violence is probably impacting the brain in a way that we wouldn't want it, or I wouldn't want that. But there may be games that actually foster more attention, and, you know, so we can't make a blanket assumption around that. I had this very interesting experience with this. I was teaching meditation. I used to teach a lot with teenagers, and I don't anymore, but I was in the past. And there was one boy showing up at my class who was so into video games. That was his thing. And I think he was definitely in the class because his mom made him go. But he was meditating, you know, he was doing it. And then one day he came in and he said, well, I decided to bring meditation to my video game. And I said, really? So what? He said, yeah, there was this point where people were fighting with each other, and, you know, there was something going on, and there was like an argument through the game and this virtual reality. And he said, I just started to meditate, and I breathed, and I got calmer, and then I gave a solution to the group that really changed everything. And at that point, I just threw up my hands and said, I don't know. You know, because I had all my judgments. Video games are really bad for kids, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we could be mindful in video games, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Question about the amount of time you need to do meditation to accrue benefits from it.
Yes.
I'm wondering if there's a minimum in terms of time per session and sessions per week.
Yes. No, this is a great question, and the honest answer is they don't really know yet. But I'll fill that out a little bit. That study that I talked about, where they had novice meditators meditate for 8 weeks, and they noticed these little changes in their brain, They did 27 minutes a day upon average over the 8 weeks. And that's when they saw some changes. Now, does that mean if it was 20 or 40 or something, you know, we don't know. We don't know. And so, and I also don't know if there's a, what is it called, dose response or something, where it just stops having any kind of value. They also don't know. But it's interesting when you think about it. It's like any skill. So there is some science around what amount of hours do you need to develop proficiency in something. So if you wanted to become proficient at the harmonica, not like really fantastic, but just good enough, how many hours do you think you would need to practice at the harmonica? 10,000? No! 40 hours, that's it. 40 hours, just to be good enough to kind of, you know, play songs for your friends. And okay, 40 hours. So you could take a whole week and practice and you'd be good at the harmonica. Mm-hmm. How about piano? They say 500 hours, which doesn't seem like that much, but how about violin? 1,200.
Wow.
1,200. How about if you wanted to be like a high school swimmer, making good record, you know, like really, really good swimmer. Yeah, it's somewhere around 5,000, something like that. So this is just, I'm bringing this up because we don't know the answer. If I were to say now how many for meditation, we don't know. But what I will say is that you got to do it. You got to practice it. The more you do it, the more you benefit. It's kind of like with exercise. You know, the research with exercise is they're always saying 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week. But they also say the more you do, the better. And I think it's probably the same with meditation, but my caveat is if you set the bar really high, you may not do it. So my feeling is the more frequent you can do it, just consistency rather than amount is better, at least when we're starting off. Does that make sense? Did I just throw out a lot of too much? No. Okay.
As there are varieties of meditative techniques, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What was the meditative technique you were encouraging them to practice?
Well, we were doing mindfulness, yeah, and it was in a variety of ways. So we did standing and walking and different ways of teaching it so that they would stay engaged. But it was this practice that we do here as well. Yeah. Okay.
Hi. Do you think that the meditation helps with reacting?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that second question. I'm not familiar with the research behind that or what's out there. In terms of reacting, absolutely. And I think for those of us who've been practicing, we have an experiential sense that we can be less reactive because of meditation. So what happens is usually when we're... I just define reacting as different from responding, right? So reacting is when you're acting out of unconscious habits just without awareness, essentially, you're just reacting. Responding is when there's a sense of choice or awareness in there. With mindfulness gives you that moment where you have a little bit of space, where you, instead of being at the mercy of your unconscious patterns, you can act with awareness and make a choice. So that definitely happens. And I think a little of that was seen in that study I was explaining about the faces. Right, it calmed you down so that you can make a more rational choice. Yeah.
The exercise analogy works for me. And there, like for exercise, for example, there's like a routine would be chest and tries, back and bys, legs and shoulders, and then you kind of you know that at a certain point, like you're going to have exercised all of your muscles. And I find that I've been coming on Mondays for maybe 6 months, and I haven't really figured out like what my routine is, and you had mentioned a couple of texts. Like, I kind of have, I think, like, I could go to the gym mm-hmm. and fuck around and probably, like, get stronger, but I'm not sure that I would really be as efficient as possible, and I'm sure there's some sort of foundation, some sort of eightfold something.
The eightfold path for the gym?
Sure, yeah. I'm sure there's some virtues, or, you know what I mean? So, if you were to recommend... just sort of a baseline, like if I were to get a trainer, You know what I mean? Just to, like, just to get the basic tools so I can educate myself on this. Because I imagine if you do it, there's probably a better way. I don't know if there's a wrong way, but I'm sure there's a better way to do it. What would you recommend?
Yeah. Okay, so partial goes back to the very first study I mentioned, which is you're going to benefit from the one you actually practice.
Let's say okay. I like mindfulness.
You like mindfulness, okay. The standard thing that I tell people is about 20 minutes a day if you can. I have people start with 5 minutes just to get them going, and then kind of bring it up to 20 to 30 minutes. And that seems to be a good average amount of time that people can fit in. But as I said, it's really important to do it what you're actually going to do, right? So not set the bar too high. So then what you might do in the meditation, well, it can be just the practice that we did today. What I like to do when I start my meditation is just check into my motivation, like why am I practicing today? And that inspires me a little bit. And then to do a sitting for a little while for the 15, 20 minutes or whatever I'm doing that day, and then end with some loving kindness practice. And so it's just a nice, simple framework that really works for people. One of the things I recommend, especially if you're just starting out, is there's lots of audio downloads, so you don't have to do it by yourself. You know, sometimes it can be really hard to just sit in silence, but if you listen to an audio, like we have audios on our website, they're free downloads. I'm sure Noah has stuff, but where you can practice along with someone. So I would say getting that, 15 to 20 minute practice as a regular thing would be a great start. Sure. Yes, behind you.
I have a question in regard to trauma and mindfulness, and also kind of like how it taps into your unconscious as well. If you can like trigger things or people that have lots of trauma, if it's good for them to sit.
Yeah, this is an important question, and it's I'm not going to give you the definitive right now, but it's. It depends on the trauma. It depends on the kind of sitting that you do or the kind of practice you do. So, for instance, someone who has very severe trauma, you wouldn't want them like doing a meditation retreat or something. That would not be smart. There are ways of practicing that can be like just simple on-the-spot practice. Like you can incorporate the tool of mindfulness into your life without kind of pushing it with a lot of meditation practice. So, yes, it can be triggering. It can be triggering for severe trauma, maybe less so for mild trauma. And if you're interested, I can give you I can tell you about an article about trauma and mindfulness that might be helpful.
And then also, everyone's kind of talking about different types of mindfulness, or different types of meditation other than mindfulness. What are some of the other
types of meditation? So think about meditation as this giant category like sports. And under sports, there's hundreds of kinds of sports. So meditation, there's hundreds of kinds of meditation. They kind of fall under a few categories. Meditation that cultivates concentration, meditation that cultivates mindfulness, meditation that cultivates qualities of the heart. Other kinds of meditation, like prayer, is a kind of meditation. You can think of it that way. There's visualization meditation. There's moving meditations like Tai Chi or Qigong. So there's really like countless meditations that are out there. And we just focus, because the center is devoted to Vipassana, mindfulness meditation, that's what goes on here. Yeah.
I'm totally new to this. And what... in dialectic behavioral therapy,
yes.
And I'm very well versed in cognitive therapy, and that kind of stopped working because I was so solution oriented. Mm-hmm. What was really attracting to me is what you had said, like the balance between acceptance and change, and to be aware of it. What I'm curious here is, for someone who's very creative, it almost seems contradictory to want to stay so much in the now and get centered and focused on one thing, and how do you balance that out? Am I totally off key here, or
no? I think it's a good question.
Creativity.
Actually, some of the research connects mindfulness to creativity, like the calming mind and coming to a non-distracted state, and out of that place, creativity can flow. So it's actually very closely linked to creativity. So it serves different purposes. Getting yourself into the present moment is not the time to spend, you know, thinking about the novel you want to write. But once you have access to that and you either are living more from that place or you know how to enter that place, then it's a great opportunity to open to your creativity from there.
Uh-huh. How many studies do you think there have to be till, like, psychiatrists, till it's an acceptable form of therapy for psychiatrists?
Yeah.
To offer over medicine?
That's a great question. How many studies before psychiatry goes, yes. I can't answer that. I don't know. I don't know how long it takes before... I've seen, in looking in 20 years, I've seen just so many leaps in acceptance, and I think, and more doctors, and there's more interest in psychiatry, but it's still pretty small. And so, one of the things that at one of... When Dan Siegel, who's a colleague of ours at our center, he goes and he gives lectures to all these mental health professionals, and he'll say, how many of you have ever had had a course in mental health as opposed to mental illness? Because psychiatry focuses completely on mental illness. And so mental health is this, like, emerging field. And mindfulness, I think, is one of the keys to mental health, right? So the kind of the twin, there's also positive psychology that's starting to infiltrate some into psychiatry. But I think it's, I don't want to make it, it's hard for me to, you know, to answer that question. But I think it's slowly, slowly, slowly we're going to see changes. Yeah. So it sounds like we've gotten to the end of our mindfulness and science discussion tonight. It's kind of good timing, so maybe we'll...
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.